I'm back again to read Hitler's War by David Irving. The Big Decision. While a never-ending stream of congratulations reached the Chancellor in Berlin, from the exiled Kaiser in Holland, from the Crown Prince, from Hindenburg's daughter, and even from Hitler's old schoolmaster in Austria, the Führer contentedly toured the Flanders battlefield of the First World War with his old comrades Amann and Schmidt. At one point, he darted off and clambered up an overgrown slope, looking for a concrete slab behind which he had once taken cover. His memory had not deceived him, for the same nondescript slab was still there, and for all we know, it lies there to this day. Colonel Schmunt had prepared an interim headquarters, Tannenberg, high up in the Black Forest. Hitler did not want to return to Berlin until he had some unofficial response to the peace feelers he had extended to the British through Sweden. He would then stage a triumphal return to the capital on July 6th and make his formal offer in a Reichstag speech 2 days later. After that, he would be free to attend Russia in 1941. Attend to Russia in 1941. Stalin was a national leader of whose strategic capability Hitler was in no doubt. He knew how to think in terms of centuries. He set himself distant goals, which he then pursued with a single-mindedness and ruthlessness that the Führer could only admire. As early as June 2, 1940, Hitler had mentioned to Rundstedt at Charleville, "Now that Britain will presumably be willing to make peace, I shall begin the final settlement of scores with Bolshevism." He obviously regarded the August 1939 pact with Stalin with increasing cynicism. It was a life insurance policy to which he had steadfastly contributed, but which he now felt had served its purpose. His victory in France had given him a feeling of immortality. There is an abundance of contemporary evidence that Hitler was still well disposed toward the British Empire. The archives of the High Command and the Navy provide ample examples. This was why Keitel rejected a proposal that Britain's food supplies be sabotaged. And on June 3rd, Hitler explicitly forbade Canaris to introduce bacterial warfare against Britain. On June 17th, Jodl's principal assistant confirmed to the naval staff that the Führer has anything but the intention of completely destroying the British Empire, as England's downfall would be to the detriment of the white race. Hence the possibility of making peace with Britain after France's defeat, and at the latter's expense, on the condition that our colonies are returned and Britain renounces her influence in Europe. With regard to an invasion, the Führer has not so far uttered any intention, as he is fully aware of the extreme difficulties inherent in such an operation. That is also why the High Command has yet undertaken no studies or preparations. The Commander-in-Chief, Luftwaffe, has put certain things in hand, e.g. the activation of a parachute division. Together with Goering, Hitler hatched a plan to offer Britain 12 divisions for overseas purposes, the defense of her empire against aggression. More realistically, Admiral Raeder urged him to launch immediate air raids on the main British naval bases and to prepare a seaborne invasion. Hitler, however, believed an invasion quite superfluous. One way or another, he said, the British will give in. On June 25th, Christa Schroeder, one of his private secretaries, wrote the chief plans to speak to the Reichstag shortly. It will probably be his last appeal to Britain. If they don't come around even then, he will proceed without pity. I believe it still hurts him even now to have to tackle the British. It would obviously be far easier for him if they would see reason themselves. If only they knew that the chief wants nothing more from them than the return of our own former colonies, perhaps they might be more approachable. On the same day, General Hans Jeschenik, the chief of air staff, refused to participate in the invasion planning by the High Command, OKW, since in his view, the Führer has no intention of mounting an invasion. When the air member of Jodl's staff nonetheless pressed Jeschenik to help, the general bitingly replied, "That's the OKW's affair. There won't be any invasion, and I have no time to waste on planning one." Hitler felt that the British public was being deliberately misled as to his war aims. Naturally, it matters a lot what the Britons expect the Führer's purpose to be in fighting their country, wrote Walter Huell to a contact in Switzerland on June 30th. They were cajoled into this catastrophe by emigre and liberal-thinking people. Now it is up to them to find some way out of this mess. The point is, can the British grasp the genius and the greatness of the Führer, not only as a benefit to Germany, but to the whole of Europe, too? Can they swallow their envy and pride enough to see in him not the conqueror, but the creator of the new Europe? If they can, they will automatically come to the conclusion that the Führer does not want to destroy the empire, as claimed by the emigre who are duping them. A few days later, Baron Ernst von Weizsäcker summed up the situation thus in his diary. Perhaps we automatically shy from taking over the immense task of inheriting both Europe and the British Empire. Conquer Britain, but what then and what for? This question of the Führer's is countered by others, like Herr von Ribbentrop, with a comparison to two great trees that cannot prosper if they grow up close together. In Weizsäcker's view, Britain would not give in unless clubbed to the ground, and only after Winston Churchill had been disposed of. Deep in the Black Forest, the Führer planned the Reich's new frontiers. Now that victory was his, he saw no reason not to gather the spoils of war. He would throw France back to the frontiers of 1540. He personally instructed the two Western Gauleiters, Joseph Berkel and Robert Wagner, to re-annex Alsace and Lorraine by stealth. Any formal German announcement that they were doing so might prompt Mussolini to enforce Italy's territorial claims against France, or even provoke Marshal Pétain to transfer his fleet and African colonies to the enemy. Hitler warned his legal experts to put as little down on paper as possible, for the new Germany would have a western frontier not enjoyed since the late Middle Ages. The line he envisaged ran from the Somme estuary southward. It gave Germany the channel ports of Boulogne, Calais, and Dunkirk, much of Flanders, all of Lorraine, the French Comté, and part of Burgundy, as far as Lake Geneva. Under the peace settlement, Hitler also had intended to oblige his former enemies, as well as the pro-Axis countries, to agree on a uniform solution of the Jewish problem. France would be required to make available Madagascar to accommodate Europe's Jews. Hitler revealed this decision to Admiral Raeder on June 20th, and evidently to Ribbentrop and Himmler soon after, for experts in the foreign ministry worked eagerly on the Madagascar plan throughout the summer. Himmler told a relieved Governor General Hans Frank that the Führer had ordered an end to the dumping of Jews in the general government of Poland after all, as they were all going to be deported overseas, including those now in Poland. At a Krakow conference, the city's police chief SS General Bruno Streckenbach quoted Himmler, "When and how the deportation begins depends on the peace settlement." It is difficult to relate the political and military developments of the summer of 1940 to the industrial and hence longer-range decisions that Hitler took. In the second week of June, he ordered the arms industry to convert to the special needs of the war against Britain. All effort must be applied to the mass production of Junkers 88 bombers and of submarines. But though the ammunition dumps were to be replenished, the peacetime consumer goods industry was restarted. The field army was to be reduced in strength immediately by 35 divisions, which would provide industry with the manpower it now lacked. The Soviet Union loomed ever larger on Hitler's horizon, as envisaged under the Nazi-Soviet Pact on June 12th. Moscow issued an ultimatum to the Baltic state of Lithuania, followed by similar demands on Estonia and Latvia. Soviet Army and NKVD police troops invaded these countries, and from the concentrations on Romania's frontier, it was clear that further moves were intended there too. Army intelligence even recorded a flood of reports that the Russians were going to invade Germany. The rapidity with which Hitler defeated France must have taken Stalin by surprise. For on the 23rd, Molotov informed Germany that despite an earlier promise to avoid war with Romania over the Bessarabian region, the Soviet Union would brook no further delay and was resolved to use force if the Romanian government refuses a peaceful settlement. To Hitler's consternation, the Russians also laid claim to Bukovina, a region formerly owned by the Austrian crown and never by Imperial Russia. Bukovina was densely populated by ethnic Germans. Hitler was determined to avoid a Balkan quagmire at all costs, and under German pressure, the Romanian government bowed to force majeure on the 28th. To his adjutants, Hitler expressed all the private anger about these two Russian moves into the Baltic states and eastern Romania that he was unable to vent in public. He termed them the first Russian attacks on Western Europe. Since the autumn of 1939, Stalin had now annexed over 286,000 square miles with populations of over 20 million people. During the last days of June, Hitler had a number of private talks with Brauchitsch, some of which General Halder also attended. Halder was concerned by Russia's steady military buildup along the September 1939 demarcation line in Poland and by her colossal armaments program. On June 23rd, Hitler ruled that the army was to be reduced from 155 to 120 divisions, although 20 of the 35 divisions to be disbanded could be reactivated on short notice if necessary. But he directed that the armored and mechanized divisions were to be doubled and that no fewer than 17 divisions were to be stationed in the east, all together with the headquarters of General George von Kukler's 18th Army. 2 days later, Halder was to be found briefing his staff on the new element in all this, which was Germany's striking power in the east. In an order to the three army group commanders on June 25th, General von Brauchitsch mentioned that the various organizational changes would be effected partly in occupied areas, partly in Germany, and partly in the east. On the last day of June, Halder explained to Baron von Weizsäcker that Germany must keep a weather eye on the east. Britain will probably need a display of military force before she gives in and allows us a free hand for the east. On July 3rd, General Halder was even more explicit. It has to be examined from the angle of how best to deliver a military blow to Russia, to extort from her a recognition of Germany's dominant role in Europe. Today, Saturday morning, Morel had written on June 29th, 1940, "I spent about a half hour alone with the Führer. He's in magnificent health. This aromatic air does wonders for him, too. He says he slept longer and better last night than almost ever before." Tannenberg was not one of his most attractively sighted headquarters. The tall pine trees sighed in the wind, and it rained heavily. There were only a few days of sunshine in the week that he stayed there, beginning on June 28th. The Italian ambassador called on him here. Hitler hinted that Germany was on the threshold of great new tasks, without being more specific. In truth, he had not yet made up his own mind which way to turn. He mentioned to Schmundt that he was turning over in his mind whether or not to fight Russia. The jug-eared Wehrmacht adjutant told Bellow of this portentous remark afterward, as they walked gloomily through the dripping forest. The scene of this exchange remained indelibly in the Luftwaffe adjutant's memory and helps to fix the timing of Hitler's decisions in the rush of history that summer. Hitler also seems to have discussed this possibility with his foreign minister and one of Jodl's staff. Whether on Hitler's direct command cannot now be discerned. Jodl's staff privately began drafting an OKW operational plan for an attack on Russia. This was Colonel Bernhard von Lossberg for his plan Operation Fritz, see page 316. By late June of 1940, Hitler suspected that the British had no intention of submitting. By the end of the first week in July, this suspicion had hardened to a certainty. That the British planned to fight on, relying on the Air Force for the defense of their Isles and a strategic attack on Germany's rear, was an unwelcome revelation for Hitler and the OKW operations staff. Hitler ordered his service commanders to start invasion preparations since, under certain circumstances, the need might arise. But the mere thought of committing upward of 30 good divisions to an opposed operation overseas must have smitten the Führer with grave apprehension. His heart was not in it. The Führer does not really want to press on against Britain, Dr. Goebbels had noted on as early as June 27th, but he may well have to if Churchill stays on, assuredly. Hitler kept putting off Goering's plans for a mass air attack on Britain, even though the British bombers continued their forays into Germany. Churchill, wrote Goebbels on the 29th, is just trying to provoke us, but the Führer doesn't intend to respond yet. This did not mean that Hitler would not continue to threaten an invasion for the purposes of strategic deception. An OKW directive signed on June 28th by Lossberg, who certainly knew that a Russian campaign was now on the cards, ordered the intelligence services to use all available channels to dupe the British into believing that Germany is preparing war against the British mainland and overseas possessions with all dispatch in the event that Britain desires to continue the fight. A German air offensive would start once the Luftwaffe had recovered its breath. Moreover, so the deception plan was to suggest Germany, Italy, and Russia would soon open a campaign against the British position in the Middle East. This was the real explanation for the five panzer divisions and the infantry divisions being withdrawn from France to the Reich. These were the divisions being moved up against Russia. Hitler, however, had drawn up no plans whatever to attack Britain. Sending for Dr. Goebbels on July 2nd, he made this quite plain. He would instead offer them one last chance in a speech to the Reichstag. If they did not accept, he would defeat them in 4 weeks. The Führer does not want to destroy the Empire, recorded Goebbels after their private meeting, because everything it loses will accrue to foreign powers and not to us. The very next day, Mr. Churchill displayed the extent of his determination to fight on. On July 3rd, he ordered his navy to open fire on the remnants of the French fleet anchored at Mers El Kibir, North Africa, an act of brigandry which killed 1,297 French sailors who had until a few days previously been his allies, and wounding 351 more. What a cunt. This was Hitler's own language, and the message reached him loud and clear. Moreover, documents captured in France demonstrated unmistakably the kind of war that Britain was preparing. Among the records of the Supreme War Council was one of a November 1939 meeting at which Chamberlain had disclosed that the British Air Staff had developed a plan to use its new long-range bombers for the destruction of the Ruhr, site of an estimated 60% of German industry. Hitler's agents had also discovered notes written by Daladier during a visit to Paris by Churchill and British air marshals on May 16th. The French Prime Minister wrote of a long technical argument with his generals, who declare to me that the German advance into France can be slowed down by bombing the Ruhr. I retorted it is absurd to believe that. Shocked by Mers El Kibir, Hitler scrapped the conciliatory speech he'd drafted for delivery to the Reichstag on July 6, 1940, and postponed the session altogether. That day, he returned to Berlin 2 months after he had sallied forth to fight the French. A public holiday had been declared in the capital. 1 million swastika flags had been distributed free to the people lining the streets to the Chancellery, and roses were scattered on the streets for Hitler's motor cavalcade to crush. Dr. Goebbels himself broadcast the running commentary over the radio network as at 3 p.m. Hitler's special train pulled into Anhalt station. The choice between attacking Britain or Russia was one that would now occupy him continuously until the end of July, and to a lesser degree, until autumn. Unexpectedly, he was now confronted by two enemies, an ugly prospect at any time, but he had only one bullet left in the breech, as he himself later graphically put it. If the RAF might bomb German industry, concerned Hitler less than the mischief Britain might create in the Balkans, the source of his oil. The planning documents recently captured in France had been an eye-opener, betraying, as they did, the sympathetic attitudes shown by Turkey, Greece, and particularly Yugoslavia toward the various moves contemplated by the Allies. In short, the Balkans could prove Hitler's undoing, and he told Italy's foreign minister as much on the day after his return to Britain. The Italians wished to invade Yugoslavia now, but Hitler urged them not to, because if they did, Hungary could invade Romania, and the entire Balkans would go up in flames. The Russians would therefore certainly advance toward their ancient Byzantine goal, the Dardanelles and Constantinople, said Hitler. Things might go so far that Britain and Russia, under the pressure of events, could discover a community of interest. By now, both General von Brauchitsch and Colonel von Lossberg, a member of Jodl's staff, had already realized that Hitler proposed a Russian campaign. On July 1, 1940, Brauchitsch had asked the War Department, OKH, to do some operational thinking about this, and Halder had asked General Hans von Greifenberg to start planning accordingly in the operations branch of the general staff. Simultaneously, Lossberg completed an OKW study of a Russian campaign, codenamed Fritz, after his son. It was some 30 pages long. Early in July, during the sojourn of the OKW command train Atlas on a siding at Grunwald Station in Berlin, he directed Captain von Trappe to obtain maps of Russia. He was undoubtedly right when later he suggested that there was a psychological factor in Hitler's decision to deal with Russia first. The Führer realized that victory in France had produced both in his command staffs and in the German people a smugness and a self-satisfaction and a savoring of the peace to come that threatened to undermine all hope of launching a superhuman crusade against the Bolsheviks. In April 1941, he was to say, "The people must always be led by the nose to paradise." Today was to say, "Today we are more powerfully armed than ever before. That is why we have to use the arms we have now for the real battle, the one that counts, because one day the Russians, the countless millions of Slavs, are going to come." In spite of this, Hitler allowed the phony invasion preparations against Britain to continue in the hope that this threat would bring the British people to their senses. Admiral Raeder argued that the British would not make peace without, figuratively speaking, a taste of the whip first. He urged Hitler to order heavy air raids on some big city like Liverpool. An invasion must be regarded only as a last resort. Hitler refused to unleash the Luftwaffe against Britain. The signs were in fact conflicting. He learned that the expatriate Duke of Windsor, who had served with the French military mission near Paris, but had now escaped through Spain to Portugal, was bitterly attacking Churchill's needless prolongation of the war, and predicting that protracted heavy bombardment would make Britain ready for peace. Hitler was perplexed by England's continued intransigence. He told Goebbels on July 6th that he had had his Reichstag speech with the peace offer ready to deliver when Churchill's bombardment of the French fleet at Mels El Kebir had upset the apple cart. He assumed that Churchill had deliberately misinformed his colleagues about Germany's armistice demands on France, for Ambassador Stafford Cripps was heard to explain in Moscow that Britain could not make peace because Germany would without a doubt demand the entire British fleet to be handed over to her. Repeating the now familiar arguments that he had heard, Halder wrote on the 13th, "The Führer accepts that he may have to force Britain to make peace, but he is reluctant to do so, because if we do defeat the British in the field, the British Empire will fall apart. Germany will not profit therefrom. We should be paying with German blood for something from which only Japan, America, and others would draw benefit." It's a weird way to phrase it, but he means we shouldn't. Having formally postponed the planned Reichstag session, Hitler left Berlin on July 8th, announcing to his private staff that he wanted to think things over. For the next 10 days, he drifted purposelessly about Bavaria and Austria, and then retired to the Obersalzberg for a week of quiet reflection. The Hungarian premier, Count Paul Teleki, brought him a letter from his regent, Admiral Nicholas Horthy, on July 10th. The letter is lost, but Horthy's handwritten draft hinted that Germany was the only power that could prevent Stalin and the Red Army from devouring the whole world like an artichoke, leaf by leaf. With Hitler's acquiescence, Joachim von Ribbentrop began an extended maneuver to win the support of the Duke of Windsor, who was now staying at the Lisbon mansion of one of Portugal's leading bankers prior to taking up a new post at Bermuda. Hitler's respect for the Duke, whom he had met in 1937, was increased by fresh reports of the latter's unconcealed loathing of Churchill and the war, and by word of his willingness to accept high office in a Britain humbled by armistice. For the moment, German policy was limited to trying to procure the Duke's arrival in an area within Germany's sphere of influence. For example, southern Spain. Ribbentrop genuinely feared the British Secret Service had evil designs on the Duke, for he sent Walter Schellenberg to Lisbon with instructions to ensure that no harm came to him. Schellenberg was also to arrange for the Duke and his Duchess to cross back into Spain if they wished. On July 11th, Ribbentrop confidently cabled his ambassador in Madrid that if the Duke so desired, Germany was willing to smooth the path for the Duke and the Duchess to occupy the British throne. By the last week of July, it seemed that Ribbentrop might succeed. The Spanish emissary quoted the Duke as saying that he would break with his brother King George and with Britain's present policies and retire to a life of peace in southern Spain. But the Lisbon embassy had impounded his passports. When the Duke had been told the time might come when he would again play an important part in English public life, and perhaps even return to the throne, he had replied in astonishment that the British Constitution had made this impossible for a king who had once abdicated. Ribbentrop's ambassador reported, "When the emissary then suggested that the course of the war might bring about changes even in the British Constitution, the Duchess in particular became very thoughtful. Small wonder that Mr. Churchill's government would make strenuous attempts after the war to locate and destroy these compromising secret telegrams." Hitler's suspicion of collusion between Russia and Britain was powerfully reinforced by reports of conversations of Russian diplomats in Moscow. These reports were intercepted by the German intelligence service. Thus, on July 5th, the Turkish ambassador reported to Ankara on a Moscow conversation with the British ambassador, Sir Stafford Cripps. Mikhail Ivanovich Kalinin, the president of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet, had assured Britain that Britain and Russia had many interests in common. It was necessary for them to arrive at an understanding. Similarly, a decoded Greek telegram sent to Athens by the Greek legation in Moscow reported on a two-hour interview with Cripps on July 6th. The Englishman had emphasized that the Russians were feverishly making war preparations, which is quite correct, noted the Greek telegram. Significantly, the Greek envoy had retorted that it appears dubious to me that if Germany believes the Kremlin definitely intends to attack, she will not take action immediately. Cripps had claimed in his reply that because Germany could not be ready to attack Russia before autumn, and even then could not endure a winter campaign, she will be forced to postpone the war against Russia until next spring, by which time the Russians will be ready too. Until then, both parties would avoid any disruption of their mutual relations. Speaking to the Turkish ambassador on July 16th, Cripps admitted, "I fully understand how delicate this matter is, but faced by imminent German attack, we are forced to come to some arrangement with the Russians, whatever the cost." These intercepted dispatches were placed in Hitler's hands on his return to Berlin. Defeating Russia was therefore vital. Defeating Britain was not. On July 16th, Hitler, without noticeable enthusiasm, accepted Jodl's draft order to the Wehrmacht to prepare an invasion of Britain, and if need be, carry it out. But the navy was more circumspect. The consequent withdrawal of 1,000 heavy barges from the German inland waterways would paralyze large sections of industry. In addition, adequate local air superiority was a sine qua non, I don't know, it's for any invasion operation. On the 15th, the OKW had orally asked the commanders-in-chief whether anything could theoretically be ready by August 15th. On his arrival now in Berlin, Hitler learned from Raeder that this would be quite impossible. Nonetheless, the Führer ordered the stage to be set. The transport ships and crews were to be marshaled along the Channel coast in full view of the British. His aim was transparent. For the Luftwaffe, meanwhile occupied with a decorum and restraint hardly compatible with the strategic objective of fighting for air supremacy. He returned to Berlin on July 19, 1940, and outlined to Dr. Goebbels that the others around his lunch table, the long-delayed speech, and the others to Dr. Goebbels and the others around his lunch table that the long-delayed speech that he now proposed to make to the Reichstag. It would contain a short, truncated peace officer office. Truncated peace offer to the British people, with the clear connotation that this was his last word on the matter. The flower-bedecked Kroll Opera House, the chosen setting for the speech, was that afternoon packed to overflowing. His delivery was as effective as ever, now narrating, now mocking, now ranting, now appealing. Its burden was an appeal to Britain's common sense. What was unorthodox was that he announced an avalanche of promotions for all his principal commanders on the Western Front. Hermann Goering must have learned that he was to be created a Reichsmarschall, one rung higher even than Field Marshal, for he had already ordered a gaudy new uniform. The peace offer fell on deaf ears. That same evening, the British journalist Sefton Delmer broadcast over the BBC a coarsely phrased rebuff, and Churchill even ordered a fresh air raid that night. Hitler still hoped reason would prevail. For the moment, Goebbels advised his diary, the Führer does not want to accept that this is indeed Britain's response. He is still minded to wait a while. After all, he appealed to the British people and not to Churchill. Before the day was over, Hitler confidently assured the 65-year-old von Rundstedt, now a field marshal, that he had not the slightest real intention of launching a cross-channel invasion. He also evidently repeated to Brauchitsch his demand that the General Staff properly explore a Russian campaign. The strategic objective that Hitler outlined echoed Lossberg's draft, codenamed Fritz, to defeat the Russian army, or at least to take over as much as Russian territory as is necessary to protect Berlin and the Silesian industrial region from enemy air raids. It would be desirable to advance so far into Russia that we could devastate the most important areas there with our own Luftwaffe. Before leaving Berlin on July 21st, Hitler collected Raeder, Brauchitsch, and Goering's chief of staff, Jeschenik, in the chancellery and explained to them the need to take the necessary political and military steps to safeguard the crucial oil imports should, as was highly unlikely, the Romanian and Russian supplies threaten to dry up. On the question of an invasion of England, Hitler concluded, if the preparations cannot definitely be completed by the beginning of September, it will prove necessary to ponder other plans. By this, he meant that he would postpone the decision on England until May of 1941 and attack Russia this very autumn. While waiting Raeder's report on the prospects for an invasion of Britain, Hitler toured Weimar and Beirut. There were now air raid wardens in the famous theater, and the printed program in his hands included a full-page announcement on what to do if the sirens sounded. On the 25th, Hitler was back in the capital. Raeder again tried to dissuade him from an invasion of Britain. Hitler asked him to report again on the position in a few days' time. His final decision may, however, have been triggered by a fresh intercepted telegram that was shown to him before he left Berlin for the Berghof in Bavaria late that evening. In it, the Yugoslav ambassador in Moscow, Milan Gavrilovich, quoted Sir Stafford Cripps' view that France's collapse had put the Soviet government in great fear of Germany. The Soviet government is afraid that Germans will launch a sudden and unexpected attack. They are trying to gain time. Gavrilovich had also discussed the growing Russian military strength with his Turkish colleague. The Turkish ambassador considered war between Germany and Russia a foregone conclusion. Hitler arrived at the Berghof in time for lunch on July 26th. Here, over the next few days, he held a series of meetings with Balkan potentates. One morning after the regular war conference in the Berghof's Great Hall, Hitler asked General Jodl to stay behind and questioned him on the possibility of launching a lightning attack on Russia before winter set in. This question was unquestionably an echo of the mocking tone adopted by Soviet leaders in their conversations with Balkan diplomats. Hitler himself referred to intercepted conversations in this connection on July 31st. He explained that he was perfectly aware that Stalin had only signed his 1939 pact with Germany to open the floodgates of war in Europe. What Stalin had not bargained for was that Hitler would finish off France so soon. This explained Russia's headlong occupation of the Baltic states and the Romanian provinces in the latter part of June. It was clear from the increasing Soviet military strength along the eastern frontier, on which Germany still only had 5 divisions stationed, that Russia had further acquisitions in mind. Hitler feared that Stalin planned to bomb or invade the Romanian oil fields that autumn. Russia's aims, he said, had not changed since Peter the Great. She wanted the whole of Poland and the political absorption of Bulgaria, then Finland, and finally the Dardanelles. War with Russia was inevitable, argued Hitler. Such being the case, it was better to attack now, this autumn. He would make one last political attempt to explore Stalin's intentions before finally making up his mind. When the Führer called his OKW army and navy chiefs to the Berghof on July 31st, 1940, his reluctance to reach a firm decision on an invasion of Britain contrasted strongly with his powerful arguments in favor of attacking Russia. Admiral Raeder sedulously gave the impression that the navy would be ready for the invasion of England by mid-September 1940. But having done so, he also advanced formidable technical reasons why they should wait until May 1941. In the coming autumn, only 2 moon and tide periods were attractive, from August 20th to 26th and from September 19th to 26th. The first was too early, and the second fell in a traditional foul weather period. If Hitler waited until May 1941, on the other hand, the Navy's fleet of battleships would be brought up to 4 by the new Tirpitz and Bismarck. That said, the Admiral returned to Berlin. After he had gone, Hitler commented to Brauchitsch and Halder that he doubted the technical practicability of an invasion. He was impressed by Britain's naval supremacy and saw no real reason to take such a risk for so little. The war was already all but won. With more marked enthusiasm, the Führer turned to other means of dashing Britain's hopes. Submarine and air war would take up to 2 years to defeat Britain. Britain still had high hopes of the United States, and she was clutching at Russia like a drowning man. If Russia were to drop out of the picture, then the United States must too, because with the USSR eliminated, Japan would be released as a threatening force in the Far East. That was the beauty of attacking Russia. If Russia is laid low, then Britain's last hope is wiped out, and Germany will be master of Europe and the Balkans. There was alas no time after all to commence a Russian campaign that autumn, as winter would set in before the operation could be concluded. But if it were started in the spring, May 1941, the army would have 5 clear months in which to defeat the Soviet Union. The army he had so recently ordered cut back to 120 divisions would now be expanded to a record 180 divisions, whereas on June 23rd, he and Brauchitsch had agreed to allocate 17 infantry divisions to the east. He now proposed that by spring, his strength there built up to 120 divisions. Neither Field Marshal von Brauchitsch nor General Halder, Chief of the General Staff, offered any objections. And that is the end of the big decision. Up next, you'll see.